So welcome, everyone, to our JCC Coffee Cake and Learning to Snatch Defeat from the Jaws of Victory. So it's an inversion of the normative way that we use that expression, right? Usually it's the Hail Moshe pass. Sorry, couldn't resist that one. It's the Hail Moses pass that the quarterback does, you know, the last play of the game, and it's tipped up, and somebody miraculously catches in the end zone. You say, wow, they snatch victory. Well, today we're going to see Jacob, Yaakov Avinu, Mr. Israel, snatches defeat from certain victory. And so we'll try to explore the hows, whys, and the context. So before we begin, you have to know a little context here. Okay, so here we go. You don't need your source sheet yet. Jacob is sent into exile by his mom and dad. Big brother Esau is really ticked off. Because if you recall, there was some subterfuge where Rebecca coerces and orders her son Jacob to put on the guise of Esau. He dresses up like his brother Esau, puts on goat skins, and he comes in and pretends to Isaac, who is blind, that he in fact is Esau. Give me the bracha, give me the blessing. And it works, kind of. He gets the blessing. But of course, Esau makes a statement that is recorded in the Torah that my dad is, you know, pretty old. He's going to die soon. Only Esau would say it that way. Well, let it come soon. And when he dies, that's the end of this Jacob character. So mom and dad are aware of this enmity between the siblings. And so they take Jacob. They say, Jacob, you know, it's time to get married. And you can't marry these Canaanite women around here because they are all idolaters of the first order. You need to go to my family, Rebecca says, where I come from, in Aram Naraim, where our ancestors all are located, to my brother Lavan's house, Rebecca tells Jacob. You'll find a young lady to marry there for sure. So they send him off. And again, we gave a whole class that he didn't directly go. He spent some years learning and fortified himself for his evil uncle Lavan. And he's at his evil uncle Lavan's house for 20 years. So this is the germane point. He wins in the end, even though he's dealing with the Ramai, the con man extraordinaire Lavan. Jacob takes everything in the end. He gets the daughters. He gets the children. He gets the stock. I mean, a literal stock portfolio, the sheepala, the goats, it all. It all becomes Jacob. No matter how evil and wicked Lavan is, Jacob triumphs. With God's help, of course. And they come home. Finally. Now, you might say, is it an exaggeration to state the evil, the reshut of this character, Lavan? No, it isn't. Because why would running away to Lavan's house be a sanctuary city for Jacob? Because even Esau, who's a wicked guy and has an army of his own, even he respects Lavan's darkness. And he doesn't want to mess with Lavan. So it's the perfect place you're going because it's sort of like running, oh, I don't know, if your empire just fell last week, you go to like Moscow. Someone just did this week, named Bashar Assad, one of the really villainous guys in our world today. You know, he was welcomed, I guess, as a sanctuary somewhere by Putin in Russia. So again, you got to go to somebody bad to protect you from even worse. So that's kind of what happened here. Jacob shields himself from direct confrontation with Esau by living at the one place that even Esau will be loath to go, and that's Lavan's house. So Jacob returns to the promised land with his family. Unfortunately, as you know, on the way, eventually Rachel's going to die. But as he comes into the promised land of Canaan, the future Israel, he sends emissaries, malachim, emissaries, messengers, FedEx guys, because there was a Canadian postal strike, of course. I'm making that as a joke. They used to joke that, you know, Canada used to be, before it kind of got a little nutty, used to be a very beautiful place to live. Americans love Canada. Canadians love Canada. Not as much today, unfortunately. But the joke used to be when I was a kid, it's a little sacrilegious, that, you know, Moses used to stutter, correct? So when he talked about where he wanted to go, he meant to say Canada, but he struggled and said Kananan. So it was supposed to be the promised land. So that's only a Canadian joke. And it is very heretical. So I apologize for the heresy of that one. But it's kind of cute. So, right, it is cute. Okay, so what happens is that he, Jacob, is coming to town. And he sends these emissaries to let his brother Esau know, I'm back in town. And the rabbis question, like, why would you poke the sleeping Rottweiler? Right? You're walking in Central Park, and there's a pit bull or Rottweiler just relaxing there. You probably would tiptoe by. You wouldn't go over and give the dog a shtoch. Hey, Adolf the Rottweiler! And he's like, right? And all of a sudden, you're on the menu. You wouldn't do that. So the question is, why would he put himself on Esau's radar, on his menu? Okay. But listen to the message. And this is all now the Torah reading from this week. He sends to his brother the following very powerful, veiled threat, but also honor. Well, how does he honor him? Let's start with the good part. He sends him 550 animals. And they're grouped and segmented in a way that each group of animals comes separately. So Esau's like, instead of like getting your 7-course meal in the Newfoundland restaurant in Canada where they don't have the wisdom that, hey, it's a 7-course dinner, maybe we don't serve everything from appetizer, soup, and dessert at one moment so that you can enjoy it and luxuriate it and then things don't get cold. No. So what he does is he brings each course out separately. So when Esau thought the gift can't get any bigger, he looks up and he sees another group of people coming with more animals as a tribute to Esau, you know, to keep him nice, fat, and happy. And then the message that the messengers deliver. He says the following. Im Lavan garti, with Lavan I have lived, Jacob sends the message to his brother Esau. Now, that's a very veiled threat. Why? Because the rabbis have a play with the word garti. They switch the letters around, and it comes out to numerology, gematria of 613. With Lavan I lived, and I kept all the rules of the Torah. I am as pious today, after living 20 years with the evil influence of my uncle, our uncle, Lavan. I am as pious and great today, Jacob says, as I was when I left home. Now, that's a powerful message to Esau, because Esau would be unimaginable. How could you live under the direct influence of dear old evil Uncle Lavan and not fall prey to the dark side, right? It's sort of like Luke Skywalker getting sucked into the dark side to join his dad and the Emperor. It's a very difficult magnetic draw. I apologize, you know I'm a big fan of Star Wars. If you don't like Star Wars, I know it's boring. But if you like Star Wars, it's a great metaphor. Okay, so what happens? He sends the message. I'm back in town. I lived with Lavan for 20 years, and here I still am. I still live. My spirituality, my Torah, intact as it was before. Plus, I have my whole powerful family. And the night before he actually meets bodily Esau, he has a famous moment. And here's the moment. You ready? So he sends the messenger. They come back and report, hey, Uncle Lavan, you know, we delivered the message from that you were with him to brother Esau. Guess what? Esau's so excited, he's coming with 400 men. And they're army guys. They're not like, you know, Girl Scouts. Right? Would you believe 400 generals coming? I find that hard to believe. Okay. That was a little shout out for Lano there. He likes that one. That was Get Smart's famous, would you believe? So 400 generals are coming. And of course, why are they coming with 400 generals? I mean, the most obvious answer is they're coming to kill me. But it could be maybe that he's paying homage to me. Maybe it's kavod, it's honor. It's not clear, but it's not great. So Jacob prays to God to help him. He divides the family up because he says, God forbid, if there's a war, I don't want to lose everyone in one fell swoop. So I'll separate out 6 of the kids over here with their children, 6 over here with the different wives. And of course, it'll be unbeknownst to Esau. He doesn't know how many kids exactly I have. So he won't know that there's a camp here and there's a camp there. So whichever camp he chooses, God forbid, to attack and to annihilate, the other camp at least will survive. So part of me will survive to fight another day. And then he crosses back over a little brook to retrieve some forgotten objects. And he has the famous story of the wrestling match with the angel. Remember the story?
Yes.
So it's a fantastic story, and people think it's a little fantastical, right? It's an angel. How do we know it's an angel? So the very simple explanation is this. It says in the Torah, I'll quote you, Vayivater Yaakov Levado, Jacob was left alone, and then a man wrestles with him. Wait a minute, you just stated that he was alone, but then a man wrestles with him? How is that possible? How do you reconcile that? Must be he was alone from humans, but the man who wrestled with him was not a human. Therefore, there's no contradiction between these two statements. I believe, again, it's just an approach, that perhaps the conflict was internal. I hate to do Star Wars again, but I'm going to do Star Wars again. Did you any of you see the first three movies at least? Do you remember the return of the Empire Strikes Back, the second movie that introduces you to Master Yoda on his little planet? Okay, so there's a remarkable scene. You don't have to see it. If you've seen it, this will bring home the moment. If you haven't seen it, don't worry. I'll explain it, okay? So there's a scene where Luke Skywalker, right, he doesn't know that Darth Vader is actually his father. Right, that's a gift. That only happens at the end of the movie where he says, "I am your father." Right? But that's the big, like, what? And you got to wait 3 years for the sequel. Right? Okay, so you don't know that yet. So he's on this planet. He's meeting the Grand Rebbe, the Grand Teacher and Rebbe and Rabbi of all the Jedi's, Master Yoda, whose name, by the way, Yodea means one who has knowledge. Yoda. So he's aptly named by the great Rabbi Lucas. I'm joking. So Yoda, the Yodea, the one who has acquired this great knowledge. I once gave a class on the Torah of Star Wars to a group of NCSY guys and girls. They ate it up to the point where I was invited multiple times to give the class. And I said, look, I gave the class once and it was fun. I said, if I start giving this class all over the place, I'm going to become known as the Star Wars Rabbi. And I don't want to be the Star Wars Rabbi. So thank you, but I'm going to pass. So what happens is he has this weird, almost like a dream sequence where he's fighting and it ends up, he stabs himself accidentally, Luke does, on his own lightsaber, wounding himself. But he sees the visage of the black helmet of Darth Vader, who he's met before, not realizing that he's probably fighting the elements of Darth Vader, his dad, that are in him because he's half Darth Vader, right? So I believe that's what's going on here. Think about it for a moment. I understand they're not identical, but they're fraternal twins. So I understand that they're not sharing exact same drop, you know, the eggs are not split, they're two separate eggs. I get the physiology of what it means to be a fraternal twin. My wife, who is the product of two fraternal twins, explained it all to me. So I'm very barur. I understand the mechanics, I think, of how it works. However, I also did some digging on my own, and even medical experts say, hey, when you share a womb with someone for 9 months, there is a connection that you would not have otherwise with another sibling. So yes, I understand maybe you're not like hearing each other's thoughts, you know, the way identical twins can be on the other side of the world and feel, oh my gosh, there's distress here in the force. You know, my cousin, you know, my twin sister so-and-so is in pain, and I can, maybe you don't feel it on that level, but there is a connection because you share a womb. It's beyond just the genetics. Okay, for sure. Okay. So I believe that inherent in Jacob is a dormant part of Esau. Just like inherent dormant within Esau are good parts. There's Jacob parts, because how can you be a product of Isaac and Rebecca, who are enormous righteous people, tzaddikim gemurim? How could you not have wonderful genetics? Even if you're Esau, you still have good stuff in you, right? You have to. So Jacob must have also shared some of the potentiality that Esau had for darkness. So I believe that when he's wrestling the night before the fateful meeting with the brother Esau, he's perhaps also wrestling within himself, trying to subdue those dormant elements that would make him like Esau. He's got to get rid of that. So he's fighting the angel. He wins. What does he ask of the angel? I will only release you if you call me Israel, if you will recognize the legitimacy of my claim to the title Israel, that I won fair and square. Now, it wasn't subterfuge. Yes, there was subterfuge when I originally got the blessing 20 years ago. But right now, I want you to acknowledge to me publicly that I am Israel, Yashrar. Yisrael comes from Yashrus, above board, absolutely clear above board. I want you to acknowledge Kisarisa im Elokim, the Iman Hashem, that I fought with divine beings, angels. I fought with men, Esau and Laban, and I won. I want you to acknowledge it. And the angel, of course, is like begging him, God's going to change your name to Israel a little later on. Just hold on. No, I need to hear from you. So the angel finally says, yes, your name is Israel. And he goes away. And then Jacob the next morning wakes up and he has just destroyed the protector angel of Esau. He's taken care of Uncle Laban for 20 years. So would you agree with me, that Jacob is at the height of his superpowers? He's young. He's strong. He has triumph over Laban, triumph over the spiritual essence of who Esau was, his protector angel. And he's coming to meet now Esau. How would you behave? Maybe not subservient, but listen to how he behaves. Okay, let's go inside. So I already quoted you number one. Don't need to do it. But look at source two. As Jacob sees Esau and the 400 generals coming, it says he prostrated himself on the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. And the rabbis even take it further. He kept bowing and bowing and bowing. Like all the way down, not just like a bow to a queen or a king, to a monarch, but like he is in the top little picture. Do you see my little clip art at the top? That is Jacob bowing down to Esau. So it's a little over the top. So when Esau sees his brother, and he already got the message, the veiled threat. Esau's a smart character. Evil, yes. Brilliant also, yes. So he knows what's going on here. My dear brother, the goody two-shoes, somehow lived with our uncle Laban for 20 years, and he's still my brother, the goody two-shoes, Jacob? And he's also aware that God's with Jacob, and Jacob has the upper hand. But then he thinks to himself, wait a minute. If Jacob truly has the upper hand, why is he acting like a schlepper? Why is he acting like he has no power? He's like moving on the ground, and he's moving on the ground like he's a gurnished, like he's a nothing. If he has these superpowers, then walk proudly to me. Let's dialogue mano a mano. Why is he acting like a wimp? Where are these superpowers? So it starts to play in the mind of Esau. But it gets worse. Look at source 3. Esau, even though he's a little perplexed, shall we say, by the subservience of Jacob, at least the Jacob he's seen visually, he offers Jacob, let's go together and conquer this world, dear brother. You'll be the rabbi, I'll be the army, and together the sons of Isaac and Rebekah, the world is our kosher oyster. So Esau said to Jacob, let us travel onwards together, and I will walk as your counterpart. Now, this is not a crazy thing, because I think I mentioned to you in the last class, I'll refresh your memory, that there are two tribes that are interlocked, two of Jacob's 12 sons, Yisachar and Zebulun. They're brothers in arms. They share the same mom and obviously the same dad. And Yisachar and Zebulun share this world and the next world. How so? Well, Yisachar used to sit, or at least primarily his children and grandchildren did, they would sit in a yeshiva, in a house of learning, and they would occupy themselves and immerse themselves in what we're doing, Torah study. Zebulun were merchants, and they traveled on merchant ships and made copious amounts of money. And then they, the brothers Zebulun, paid for all the tuition costs and support of the families of Yisachar. And Yisachar took 50% of their reward for learning Torah and being pious. And they gave 50% of that reward in this world and next world to their brother Zebulun. So they were literally this partnership. that perhaps in another world, Esau could have been the merchant supporting Jacob, and Jacob could have been in the tent of learning, occupying himself in peaceful learning of Torah. But it didn't work out that way. So that's not such a crazy offer then, right? If in the lens of that backstory, that's kind of maybe what Esau's offering. Hey, why don't we go together? I'll be the military guy. You'll be the goody-two-shoes Torah guy. And together we'll conquer the whole world. This world and the next world. It's ours. And listen to what Jacob says back. This is where he snatches defeat from the jaws of victory. He says, number four, Yavor Adoni lifnei avdo, Genesis 33. Please let my master pass ahead of his slave, his servant. Wow. Listen to those words. Please let my master, you Esau, pass on before me. I'm the schlub. I'm the slave. I'm the servant. Go on ahead of me. You will have primacy in this world. I'm chopped liver. If anyone likes chopped liver, I apologize. But you know the metaphor. Now, this is so primal. Look at what the Talmud teaches us in Source 5. If you think that I'm overstating this, look at Source 5. Amazing. For 26 years, Rome, who are descendants of, you want to guess? Esau. For 26 years, Rome kept her treaties with Israel, but then turned and subjugated Israel after 26 years. Why? It's from our verses that we just did. Originally, the Romans followed the lesson of Esau's first offer. He was magnanimous and said to Jacob, hey, let us travel onwards together and I will walk as your counterpart. So the Romans thought, well, hey, if it's good enough for dear old Gramps, Esau, to offer the Jewish people solace and partnership, it's good enough for us. So the Romans let the Jewish people live in peace and relative calm for 26 years. But apparently they were really bad at learning Torah, so it took them 26 years to reach the next verse, which was Esau's response. But then they followed the lesson of Jacob's reply. What did Jacob say? No, pass ahead, please, my master. They said, oh, well, wait a minute. Dear old Gramps, Esau was rebuffed. Those Jews really don't respect us. Forget it. We're not keeping those treaties anymore. Let's go burn the temple down. Let's wipe out Judaism. Wow. So you see that this pigishat, this fateful moment where the two brothers are meeting, it doesn't just have ramifications for the moment that they're living in. This is historical because Esau, according to the rabbis, is the precursor and father, basically, of Western civilization. And there are fantastic things in Western civilization. And then there's not so fantastic things about Western civilization. So as much as the Greeks and the Romans gave the world so much, they also caused incredible pain, suffering, torture, and agony, right? So for all the Platos and Socrates and all the wonderful things, the Greeks also did some very bad stuff. Not so much Alexander, because he was at least with the Jewish people, he was okay. Alexander from Macedonia. But as we know, the Greeks were the precursor to the Romans, and some of that good stuff came to the Romans. But even with the good stuff in the Greeks, we still have some holiday called Hanukkah coming up. So it wasn't all latkes and jelly donuts, right? But with the Romans, it got really ugly. I mean, isn't there a movie out now, Gladiator Part 2? I mean, what they did was a horror, the way they beat their interpersonal relationships. That's all Esau. So you see that the words that are going back and forth here are not just like little light words between brothers in arms or brothers not in arms. They have historical, eternal ramifications. How will Jacob relate, meaning how will the Jewish people relate to the nations of the world? And how will the nations of the world specifically relate to the Jews? And you know kind of a lot of the answer from history. But let's now carry on in our travel, shall we? So number six. So not only did Jacob act like the schlub, the servant, and was subservient, but the entire period that Jacob spent in Beit El for the next years, He would continuously honor Esau with more tribute. I mentioned at the outset that he gave like 550 animals as a present. He kept coming. More and more and more. It was Hanukkah every month. Esau acted offended. But he kept his hand open the whole time, right? They're like the guy who, you know, you're giving them the gift. Oh, you shouldn't have. You shouldn't have. No, no, no. Really. Right? That's Esau. Sort of like Johnny Carson. I think I shared that story when my father, Uncle Sean, went. He was in L.A. for some newspaper meeting. And he actually got to see the Tonight Show filmed. And he said that when Johnny comes out, of course, the place rightfully explodes. He's Johnny Carson. But what you, and on TV, you see him like after 20 seconds, 30 seconds of applause, he starts to get a little sheepish, you know, and he's like this. My father, Uncle Sean, said, under the camera angle where you couldn't see, he was going like this. So that's kind of Esau, right? No, brother. You know, keep it coming. All right. So we see that one of the approaches that Jacob clearly has with Esau is to just give him copious tribute all the time. Why would that be? We'll come to that in a moment. Okay? Number 7. Amazing statement. The world was created only for the completely evil or the completely righteous. For one, there was created Olam Haba, the world to come, for the completely righteous. For the other, there was created Olam Hazeh, this world, which is for the people who are not so righteous, because they should enjoy themselves in this world. And the next world, that's where the fun stops. But they should have fun now. Now, why is that germane? Because think about Esau for a moment. Is he a man of religion? No. He is a man of here. In fact, the blessing that Isaac ends up giving Esau is for the here and now. You should have plenty here. Here it is. This world is your world. Now, Jacob, he can benefit from whatever Esau leaves over. Yeah, that's true. It's not like Jewish people have to be living in poverty, God forbid. But our focus is not just on the here and the now, it's also on the later. Our approach is an eternal approach. That's unique to Jacob. Now, why is that important? Because, you see, for Jacob, he understood that what is going on now is a preparation for what will come in the next world. But Esau, who is wicked, he's the guy described as someone who's a wicked person, he has to enjoy the here and now, because that's all there is. If he starts focusing on the religious aspects, it's not going to give him fruit. The fruit will not be his to enjoy. He'll be bitter, he'll be jealous, he'll be angry. In fact, look at number 8. Esau hated the birthright in the first place, meaning to be Jewish, to be religious, to keep the Torah, all those fun things that we do. And he would have eventually begged Jacob to take it off his hands, even if he would have had to pay him. So in other words, when Esau in the moment hears, your brother came deceptively, Isaac says, and he took your blessing. He's like, ah, right? But it's not so much, ah, that I didn't get the blessing, because I don't really want that dumb religious blessing to be Jewish. Who wants to be Jewish? Who wants to have to pray 3 times a day and keep all the 613 rules? Esau, that's not for me, Esau would say. But I don't want my brother to one-up me. So that's what really ticked Esau off, was that he lost out. There was a competition. But in the end, when he would step back from the moment where he lost the blessing, he would have said, hey, guess what? I'm very happy. You know what? Jacob, you be the goody tissues. You do this Jewish nonsense and keep the Torah, be pious. I'm just going to enjoy life. I'm going to eat, rape, murder, and be merry. Because that's who I am. That's my essence. And I will be happy in this world. I don't want the religious part. So I have just given you now the approach, I believe, of Jacob. Why would he snatch defeat from victory? Because what he was doing is he was allowing big brother Esau and his progeny, including the Romans and everybody else, to relish this world, to conquer this world, which they literally did. It's not a metaphor anymore. Conquer the world. Enjoy the world. Maximize your pleasure in this world. And why would Jacob allow all of this? Why would he be bowing and bowing and saying, even though I have superpowers, I beat an angel and I was with Laban and I have the power maybe to really take care of you, Esau, but I'm going to acquiesce and give everything to you for this world? Jacob was a genius. He knew the essence of his brother Esau. He knew what Esau wanted. You know what Esau wanted? He wanted exemption from religion. So he was exempting him. He's saying, look, this is for you. I don't want to be your partner. Because if I'm your partner, I'm bringing religion into the mix with Esau. I have to keep my distance. My children are going to have to really stay away. We'll have a relationship. But part of that relationship will be predicated on, we're going to give you lots of money. Which, of course, historically, the Jewish people always have supplied money. Always. For Esau's family. We've always been the ones giving them money and inventing things to make their lives more prosperous and more fun and more eventful, right? I mean, just look at history. It's true. We have always supplied that. Now, did it work? Kind of. Sometimes. But unfortunately, not always. Because Jacob's plan was brilliant. He wanted to keep his brother Esau religiously uninvolved. He wanted him to be sort of a non-committed guy who doesn't even go to temple, doesn't go to synagogue. He's not really interested. Maybe once in a blue moon he gets invited to a bar mitzvah and they have a good meal after, he'll go. Otherwise, he's not interested. And it doesn't affect him, so it doesn't diminish his joy because he doesn't want guilt. He wants Esau to be free to be like the pig in the mud. And very often it works, where Esau can revel in everything this world has. But it didn't work. 100%, tragically. And why did it not work? Because there were elements of Esau that did desire, I don't want to call it religion, because that's too heavy a word, but they desired more than just this world. And you know who they are, so let's discover who they are. Look at source number 9. When Esau heard his father's words, the father Isaac said, "Your brother came deceptively and took your blessing." When he heard those words, you know what Esau did? He screamed an exceedingly anguished and bitter cry. "Bless me too, my father." That's in Genesis 27. Stop there. Keep your finger there for 1 second. So in that moment, in that one moment, the rabbis say Esau found religion. He regretted the enormity of what he was giving up by not having the Jewish heritage, to become Israel, to become holy. In that moment, it was a sincere cry of hurt and anguish. He got over it very fast, but it was a sincere, pitiful cry. How deadly was that cry? Wow, was it deadly. Look at the next, number 9, the middle. Mordechai knew what was happening. The edict to annihilate all the Jews that Haman got signed and authorized by the king Ahasuerus went out, and Mordechai heard. He knew what was happening. Mordechai tore his clothes. And what did Mordechai do? He cried an exceedingly anguished and bitter cry. Book of Esther. The exceedingly anguished and bitter cry that Mordechai emitted was in response to the exceedingly anguished and bitter cry that Jacob, Mordechai's ancestor, inflicted on Esau, Haman's great-grandfather. There had to be an accounting. So in other words, in one moment of pure regret, Esau creates Haman, or the potentiality for the destruction of the Jewish people. Just from one moment of crying, he inflicted pain on his big brother, Jacob did. Therefore, there has to be an accounting somewhere. And that accounting came out in the story of Purim. Now, where, you might ask, how did he come to be Haman? So look at the next, number 10. Timnah was a mistress to Eliphaz, son of Esau. Eliphaz was the firstborn of Esau. She wanted to join the Jewish people, this lady named Timnah. And she approached Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. But none of them would have her because she was a nut job. She was eccentric. So she went to become a mistress, a concubine, to Esau's son Eliphaz, saying, "I would rather be a maid among this nation than a princess among any other. What came of her? Timnah was a mistress to Eliphaz, the son of Esau, and she bore him Amalek. Oh my gosh. Timnah had one child only with Esau's son Eliphaz. That means it's Esau's grandson. That's Amalek. That's Hitler. That's Haman. It came because this fanatical woman, Timnah, took her insane outlook. She was a princess, and she became a prostitute because she desired to be part of Abraham, Sarah's, Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob's family. At any cost, I want to be. They must have sensed in her when she came forward, this woman's a little wacky. We don't want her to be part of the Jewish family. She's just not the right person. She's off. But when she was so off that she gave up her princess rights, became basically a concubine, a prostitute, and then she gets a baby. She infuses in the baby, Amalek, her nuttiness, and the dormant part of Esau that's evil. So, in other words, Esau himself couldn't create Haman or Hitler. He wasn't that evil. But Timnah, together in partnership, created this monstrous entity known as Amalek, which is the end. All right, we're not there yet. Skip over, go to number 11. Now, how bad, how monstrous is Haman? How is he different than Esau? In what major way? This is just a little footnote that I think you'll find very interesting. So Haman says to the king, if the king Ahasuerus is willing, Haman says, sign a decree to destroy the Jews, and I, Haman, will personally hand over 10,000 talents of silver, about $400 million, between friends. Now the king eventually said, you know what, I'll sign for free. Keep your money, Haman. I'm in with you. And he signs the letter, kill the Jews next 13th of Adar, right? Haman not only can't be bribed with tribute the way Esau was bribed. Remember, we were told earlier that every month Jacob unfailingly would send money and gifts and things as a tribute to bribe Esau into being apathetic and not worrying about the Jews. Not only would Haman and Amalek not be bribable, they would pay money for the right to kill the Jews. And by the way, this is historically true. This is very sad. One of the saddest, most tragic chapters of the 6 million that we lost was what happened in Hungary. Hungary was untouched, essentially, until 1944. And then there were mass deportations, and the Hungarians went to Auschwitz. What was going on? So historically, Hungary was the richest per capita Jewish country in the world. And they had always been able to get out of anti-Semitic jams by buying their way out. You just pay off the right officials, and they look the other way, and the Jews get a pass. They believed, unfortunately, that the same would be true of the Nazis, that they could just, give some Deutschmarks or whatever they were called back then, some gold and some money, and they could just bribe their way out, and they would get a pass. But it didn't work that way. Because as you just saw, Haman's willing not only, he's not going to take a bribe to not kill the Jews, he'll pay money to kill the Jews, right? So you can't get out of it by bribing him the way you could with Esau. So we see that Jacob had a very powerful vision of the future of the Jewish people, that they were going to share a darkness. When he sees the ladder with the angels going up and down in this vision, he sees this darkness, this interminal diaspora. Because the last angel going up represented the darkness that we're in right now, this last exile since year 70, and the Romans destroyed our second temple. Well, who are the Romans? We already established that. They're descendants of Esau. So he already saw Jacob in that vision of the ladder that darkness would be interminable, that every rung on that ladder represented a year where the Jewish people would be in diaspora, that they would not be allowed to rebuild the temple and live in Israel. We're still there right now. Even though we have Israel, we don't have a temple, so we're still in the literal diaspora right now. So we are still subject to what's going on right now in this dialogue. So Jacob saw all of this, and he saw that that in history, the only way that Jewish people could survive would be to keep Esau apathetic about religion, keep him away from religion, keep him fat and happy, makes sure he has lots of money to spend, enjoys all what the world has to offer. But then, of course, he couldn't account for this insane woman, Timna and Amalek. That's like a variable. That's a quantum mechanical sort of little variable that got thrown into the mix that nobody could account for, the just the pure hatred that you can't even pay the people not to kill you. I mean, how insane is that? Most people at some point, you really have to hate someone a lot to give up your own fortune for the right to kill them. I mean, that's not a sane position in any world that I've ever lived in. So listen to this. Source number 12. Said Jacob to the Holy One, Master of the universe, do not allow Esau's heart's desire. Do not remove his bit. A bit would be like in an animal, you know, that they bite on, like a horse or whatever, to keep them from biting. This prayer that Jacob said to God refers to Germania of Edom, Germany of Edom. For if they were to be let loose, they would destroy the world. Now, there wasn't a Germany when this Talmud, Tractate Megillah, was written down in the year 500. But there obviously, it's talking about there were Germanic people living in Europe. And they were the ancestors of what became eventually Germany. Austria-Hungary Empire, or in the German Empire, and it became Germany. So Jacob is actually praying to God here. He sees that, hey, I can control Esau by buying him off. But oh my gosh, if this Germania part of Esau, meaning the Hitler Amalek Haman part, if that ever gets loose, God help the Jewish people, because we're not going to survive that. So you see, it's amazing that Jacob had the amazing ability to deal with brother Esau. And he's bowing and bowing and giving him this world. He's basically saying, I don't want to be your partner in crime. You go on ahead, rape and pillage the world. The Jews will stay in the back. We'll take care of you. We'll give you bribes. By the way, what keeps Esau, by and large, relaxed our world? The monetary system in our world. It gives him the ability to invest and to be very happy. You don't want to know what family created the monetary system of the Western world? You know them. They're called the Rothschild family. You know this is true. Historical fact. They created the Western monetary system, which keeps Esau alive and well. Okay, hang on to your brains. Rothschild. Translate it for me, please. Roth means red in English. Child is shield, protector of the red one. Who's the red one? Esau. He's Edom, the red one. The name of the Jewish family that created the banking system that protects and allows Esau to be Esau. You can't make it up. Their name was Shield, Protector of the Roth, of the red guy. Wow. Now, again, I don't know what that means. My Rebbe taught it. I'm just giving that to you over. When I heard that the first time, I was like, you know, like probably like you are now, my mind was like, what? But it's true. And I looked up, it's a historical fact, Rothschild, Rothschild. That's what their name means. Am I my brother's keeper? That's what the Rothschilds did. So again, there isn't an easy takeaway, except we now understand the battle plan historically of Jacob, how brilliant Jacob was, how there was a variable that he couldn't account for. There was this whole issue of Haman and the hatred and enmity that was out of the control of Jacob at the time that he's meeting Esau on the battlefield. We understand why he, at least in the moment, seemed to snatch defeat from victory. He could have vanquished Esau. Instead, he realized, oh my gosh, I got to deal with Esau. My children are going to deal with this character for generations. I have to have a plan. We have to keep him happy, well-fed, monetized, so he can enjoy every little fruit of this world. And there's a whole nother class that I could give. I'm not going to touch on it right now. But there's a whole religion aspect. And I'm just going to mention it to you in passing. Remember we said that the world is only for those who are completely righteous, this world and the next world, or completely wicked, then they get this world. So as long as Esau had no designs on the blessings of Jacob, as long as he doesn't want to become the Jewish people, relatively calm exists in the relationship with the Jewish people and Esau. But there was another unknown variable that came along. I'm just going to touch on it because it's true. I'm sorry if I don't want to offend anybody. It's called the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church. What did the Roman Catholic Church say to the Romans, you're Israel. They don't believe that they are something else. They believe that they are Israel. They're the new Israel. This is a fact. Okay? So they offered Esau what? The ability to become the Jews, the new Israel nation. Right? There's a new Brit Chadash. There's a new covenant between God has given up on the Jews because of their crimes. There's a new potentiality. So they offered Esau, unfortunately for poor Esau, the ability to have religion come back. So what is one of the greatest things the church introduced, much to the consternation of our people? Guilt. It's about a lot of guilt there. So what did Esau feel? Guilt. So what's the worst thing we learned today that you could give Esau in this world? That he feels guilty about all the crimes that he's committing. So when you introduce that variable of guilt, and that he still has hope of getting Jacob's blessing through this new manifestation of religion, but yet you're not allowing him to fully express himself in this world. You're suppressing Esau and making him into a goody-two-shoes Jacob, which he's just not going to find enjoyment. Now, we're talking in very broad strokes here, okay? But again, this is another class for another day. But I just wanted to show you the expansiveness of this discussion, how the variables come, and they're so extraordinary because they're all embedded here in how religion plays into the relationship between the Jews. And you know yourself, if somebody has a hope for something, even if there's just a hope, they don't give up on it. And it can cause real, real problems. And between the Timnah fanaticism, that princess who gave it all up just to be part of the Jewish people from some weird way, and then Esau was doing okay and taking bribes, but then all of a sudden that new element, Haman, Amalek, won't take a bribe. They refuse to take money. They'll smile and say, hey, I want to kill the Jews. I don't care what the costs are. I'll pay for the honor, right? So when you introduce that, that becomes an issue. And then we and Jacob wants to keep Esau and his progeny. Again, who exactly are the progeny of Esau? That's you have to run your ancestry DNA to find out. I'm talking in very broad strokes. I hope I didn't insult anyone today. That wasn't my intention, okay? If you want to discuss this off the record, I'm going to say thank you, everyone, and I'll close out the class.